Good afternoon, Your Honors. In its presentation, the state conceded that if a penalty goes from zero to some sort of punishment, that would violate ex post facto. It argues that somehow this case is different because there is a new triggering event. But that concession is the entire issue here. Mr. Rosado was previously not liable for any sort of punishment, and now the state is charging him and making him liable again. This is exactly what the ex post facto clause prohibits, and what the court in Stogner and what the highest court in New Jersey has held since 1881, that reviving a time-barred prosecution violates the ex post facto clause. However, Your Honors don't even need to reach that issue if you find that the statute was, or the amendment to the statute was intended to apply prospectively. Based on the plain language of the 2002 amendment, the act was to be effective immediately. This court should find that that language on its own requires a prospective application of the statute. Therefore, the 1989 version is the only version of the statute of limitations that applies. The statute of limitations expired on May 28, 1995, and the charge here must be dismissed as time barred. The appellate division correctly held so, and this court should affirm. This concludes my opening statement. The plain language of the statute here does say effective immediately, and the state's reading of the retroactivity of the 1996 amendment and the 2007 amendment is actually backwards. There's a presumption that statute of limitations is applied prospectively, and then we also have language on top of that from the legislature that says this is to be effective immediately, which we assume the legislature follows this court's precedent, which has held that that means that the statute should be applied prospectively. The fact that the legislature carved out a class of cases to be applied retroactively in the 1996 and 2007 amendments shows that they knew they could do so and decided not to do so in the 2002 amendment to the statute of limitations. That itself is, again, evidence that this should be prospective. There are no clear legislative intent, even in the legislative history, if Your Honors get to that question, although I argue that you don't need to. The actual sponsor statement does not say anything about a DNA backlog. The DNA backlog statements were about a bill that was not actually passed. And as the court's own brief states, the language was substituted from completely getting rid of the statute of limitations when there was DNA to a tolling exception for the five-year limitation. So it's a completely different statutory language that is eventually enacted with a different sponsor statement that makes no mention of any sort of retroactivity. So nothing in the legislative history here says that this should be applied retroactively. So that could be as far as Your Honors go and find that this should be this should be applied prospectively. However, if Your Honors do find that it is intended to be retroactive, doing so would violate the ex post facto clauses of both our constitutions and the U.S. Constitution. The question here is, under the retroactivity analysis, is the law retroactive? Does the law retroactively impose additional punishment to an already completed crime? And the Stogner court's holding is clear. A law enacted after expiration of a previously applicable limitations period violates the ex post facto clause when it is applied to revive a previously time-barred prosecution. That is exactly what is happening here. Mr. Rosado could not have been prosecuted on May 28, 1995, and the state concedes even that he could not be prosecuted between that date and January 3rd, 2002. So what the state is seeking to do here is to revive a previously time-barred prosecution. That is the clear holding of Stogner. Three other state Supreme Courts have found the same in their own DNA exception statutes of limitation that were later passed. This court should hold the same because there's no exception under Stogner for DNA. And there's no other case law that the state can point to why that would be any different.
Do you have a citation to any of those three cases you just mentioned?
The three state Supreme Courts.
Yes. That is the Tipton v. Montana 13th Judicial District Court, which is 421 P3D 780. And that's a 2018 case from Montana. The second is State v. Garcia, and that's 169 P3D 1069, and that's Kansas from 2007. And then State Ex Rel Nicholson v. State, which is 169 SO 3D 344. And that's Louisiana from 2015. And all of them are cited in my brief as well.
Do you know of any case that comes out the other way?
I have not found any other case that comes out the other way.
Are you aware of any cases that have tested the federal DNA statute of limitations extension 3297?
I have not. And the cases that generally looking at Stogner, the cases that cite it are for the proposition that an extension while a statute of limitations is ongoing has no ex post facto problem. It is only when the statute has already been, or the previous statute of limitations has already run, that Stogner applies. And so most of the federal cases that cite Stogner are simply saying that Stogner leaves open the possibility for an extension rather than a revival.
The state says, well, that's different because Stogner dealt with an identified defendant. This defendant was unidentified at the time that the statute of limitations expired. Why is that argument wrong?
The Stogner holding does not mention the actual conclusion. It says, we conclude that it's about a time-barred prosecution, and it's not about the individual that's identified. It's the prosecution that the state is bringing. Although there was an individual identified in that case, the Stogner holding does not depend on it, or it potentially could be considered a separate holding, that it was especially unfair in that case because of the individual already identified for decades. But in this case, the fact that there is no identified individual until 2018 or 2021, depending on when the DNA was completely matched, does not indicate that Stogner does not hold. And in fact, the Montana Supreme Court has held that, and this court should hold the same, that the fact that a individual was identified should have no bearing on the fact that the state has no power to prosecute in the case.
Counsel, what's the triggering event for the statute of limitations?
Back in 1989, the triggering event was the offense, and so it was the day after the offense was committed that the statute of limitations began to run. In 2002, the legislature amended it so that the triggering event was either the date that the crime was committed, or if there was DNA found, the day that the state has possession of both the DNA sample from the evidence and also a DNA sample from the suspect.
Whichever is later,
yes. So for offenses that happened before or after January 3rd, 2002, say that there was a robbery that happened in 2003 and DNA was found and no one was matched until 2010, there wouldn't be any issue with having the five-year statute of limitations would start running in 2010 when the suspect's DNA was found by the state. So that it still is a workable statute. It still very much is a simple reading of the statute to say that this tolling exception still applies to cases that happened after 2002. It's just not able to pick up things that happened after a statute has already expired.
What do you say to your adversary's argument that the combination of the 1996 statute and the 2002 statute give us this very sort of hybrid, unique circumstance where in a sex assault case that now doesn't have a statute of limitations, we have this circumstance where somebody who was never identified and now DNA evidence for the first time is the only evidence tying them to the offense sort of creates this hybrid circumstance where we can now apply it in a post-2002 world?
No court has ever held that there is a DNA exception to the ex post facto clause, and that's what's at issue here, is that there is a statute that afterwards grants complete amnesty. And when we look at since 1881, the Court of Errors and Appeals here in New Jersey talked about a vested right to immunity after the statute of limitations expired. And so Mr. Rosato has that vested right to immunity because that initial statute of limitations expired. There is no balancing test here. The ex post facto clause is a categorical bar to prosecution after the ending of the prior statute of limitations. And so this hybrid theory cannot hold when the ex post facto clause is so clear, and the Stogner and the Moore courts have been so clear as well, that reviving a time-barred prosecution per se violates the ex post facto clause. unless your honors have any other questions.
Just one, and not looking to hold you to the answer here, but if the court were to uphold the appellate division, could the state bring charges, homicide or felony murder charges?
I don't see why not. There was no statute of limitations for homicide, so they would be able to bring any homicide charges that they could present evidence to the grand jury for.
Thank you. Mr. Shalom.
May it please the court, I'll start by agreeing with that answer. I don't see any ex post facto or statute of limitations limitation on the state proceeding with a homicide charge. Stogner is pretty clear law, but we've heard two rationales for why it might not apply in this case, and I'd like to just spend a minute on each to explain why they can't be. The first is the unknown offender, unknown suspect exception, and the other is the DNA exception. Starting with the unknown suspect exception, putting aside the fact that that's not a fair reading of Stogner does not suggest that its opinion turns on whether or not the offender was known or not. What that would mean is that for a person to benefit from a statute of limitations defense, they would first need to go to the police and say, I didn't commit this crime, but I was there, or I knew the person, or I saw them, or I had lunch with them, or breakfast. And that sort of self-incrimination is not something our courts have ever required, even in the context of speedy trial, where we call on defendants to assert their right. It's only after the prosecution has been initiated. We never ask someone who is yet to be charged to go give the police a tip, because that's how they start triggering their rights. And the DNA exception, you know, when you read the state's brief, they talk in really laudatory terms about the power of DNA evidence. And DNA evidence is undoubtedly powerful, but it also has limitations. And I think the limitations are painfully obvious in a case like this, because what DNA tells us is that two people's genetic material mixed at some point. It doesn't provide dates, it doesn't provide context, it doesn't provide information on timing. And in a prosecution like this, where the allegation is that Mr. Rosado sexually assaulted someone who was sufficiently intoxicated, the timing matters, right? That they had sex doesn't end the inquiry in the case. We would need to know when and the condition that Ms. Negger-Smith was in at the time, and those things DNA doesn't talk about. When we talk about how that the purposes of ex post facto, and I take Mr. Pompilio at his word, I haven't actually gone back and read the Federalist Papers in preparation for this argument, but the abuses may have been something really horrific. But when we think about statutes of limitations, what we think is they let people let their guard down. And so at a certain point, they stop worrying about, do I have alibi witnesses? Can I remember where I was that day? And we think there's a kind of due process reason for that. And in this case, that time period passed in 1995.
There is no due process objection to a legislature saying for this particular crime there will no longer be a statute of limitations.
So long as it hasn't expired. Absolutely true, right? So had the 96 amendment been in 94, there would have been no argument for Mr. Rosado. But it wasn't. And the 96 amendment was after the expiration, and Stogner, I think, is crystal clear. Though I also agree with Ms. Burke that the easiest way to resolve this case is as a matter of pure statutory interpretation, the prospective only analysis.
Questions, anyone?
Thank you,
Mr. Shlum. Ms. Domingo.
May it please the court. I recognize your honors today has been a long session already, so I will keep my remarks brief. And I will adopt the points already made by my esteemed colleagues and simply add the following. The issue before this court is of utmost importance to the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers of New Jersey, whose mission is to protect and ensure compliance with individual rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution and the New Jersey Constitution. What the state is looking to accomplish here undermines the very fabric of our criminal justice system. The state is seeking to remove the constitutional safeguard of the ex post facto clause in order to prosecute an alleged crime that happened more than 30 years ago and is time barred. We urge the court to affirm the appellate division's sound opinion. The ex post facto clause is not just a legal technicality, it is a vital safeguard within our criminal justice system. If this court does not affirm the appellate division, fairness and predictability of legal consequences goes out the door. So does the protection against potential abuse or overreach by the legislative branch. I want to answer some of the questions that were posed earlier. Chief Justice Ravner, you asked, can a statute of limitations be told after it has expired? And the simple answer to that is no. Our case law permits the extension of statute of limitations for cases where the statute of limitations has not yet expired. That is what the 1996 amendment did with the clawback. But what it is attempting to do here is to revive a crime, an alleged crime that already is time barred, and that is not permissible. Justice Patterson, you also asked whether there is a due process violation if in the case of the 1996 amendment where the statute of limitations is now being extended. And the correct answer to that, as Mr. Shalom pointed out, is that there is no due process because there's no due process violation because you've now been put on notice. The statute of limitation has not yet expired, and you have now put on notice that that has now been extended. That is a different distinction from what the state is trying to accomplish here. And so I would submit to the court that here, the 2002 amendment must be construed to be prospective, not retroactive, because otherwise there would be an actual constitutional violation. And any advances in DNA technology, I would submit, does not and cannot overcome that fundamental interest protected by the ban on ex post facto laws. So I would submit, Your Honors, that the appellate division was correct in its reasoning, and we ask this court to affirm its holding. And unless the court has any additional questions, I yield my time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. I will be brief. Before I get into my short rebuttal, there are some questions that I wanted to answer. I believe one of them was your question, Justice Weiner-Apter, about federal cases that were cited. Mr. Pompilio was referring to United States versus Lopez. That case is cited in the state's brief on certification. And in Lopez, the court rejected an argument that the prosecution was time barred because it occurred more than 5 years between the commission and prosecution of a Hobbs Act case because the plain language of the federal DNA amendment that the limitations period was triggered when an individual is implicated through DNA testing, not when he could have been implicated. There was no ex post facto issue in that case because the DNA statute had been in effect prior to the commission of the crime.
The federal DNA statute ever been applied to a case where the statute of limitations had expired before the DNA? I believe the DNA statute went into effect in 2004. So has it ever been applied to a case where the statute of limitations had already expired at that time?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor. Another question I think that you posed as well, and I believe that Ms. Burke responded to, that there were no cases out there, state cases out there, that retroactively applied statute of limitations. And I cited earlier in my discussion state Quinn versus State, which was a Indiana Court of Appeals case from 2015. The citation for that is 45 Northeast 3rd, 39. And in that case, as I mentioned before, the court found no ex post facto violation for the application of a 2009 DNA extension of statute of limitations to a 1988 rape case that had a 5-year statute of limitations that had expired. And that case is also, that was the citation for that case. So there is a case out there that does do that, Your Honor. And then I believe Justice Patterson, I think you might have had a question concerning the 1995 amendment to the statute of limitations that was not enacted. And it was not enacted, but that amendment attempted to do the same thing that the 1996 did, which was to remove the statute of limitations in its entirety as it applies to sexual assaults. What I don't know is whether or not they had that language that limited it only to cases that had not, where the statute of limitations had not applied or had not expired. I do not know if that was in there, but that was in 1995, and Mr. Pompilio was talking about that. That is also referenced in the state's brief. I think in a few last minutes, I want to comment quickly that the statute of limitations is not inviolable, and that is something that we can see through the various amendments. We can see through the case law. It is a creature of the legislature, and the legislature can change it, and they have done so on numerous occasions in many situations. They have not always done so, perhaps in a way that effectuates their real purpose. But that said, it is not something that is to be viewed as etched in stone in a lot of respects. With respect to the ex post facto law, that is etched in stone, but it is also subject to interpretation and change as things progress. And the Calder categories, which were the original foundation of the ex post facto law, or at least has always been interpreted being the original foundation, have been subject to change. And Stogner was one of those cases that interpreted it a little bit broader than it was originally intended, we would argue. But Stogner is the rule. It's the Supreme Court rule that we need to follow and we look to. And that's one of the main reasons why the state has argued, perhaps insisted, that our case is different. And because of these distinctions that were made in Stogner, you heard the defense say that Stogner did not create a DNA exception. Stogner never dealt with DNA. The evidence in question in Stogner was memory. It was reporting. It was individuals reporting a known individual to the police. That was the triggering event. It was not an unknown person, and it was not DNA evidence. So all of the things that underlie a statute of limitations to protect a defendant from stale evidence were all in play with Stogner. They are not necessarily in play here. The other factor, and Mr. Shalom talked about DNA evidence and talked about how DNA evidence isn't the only thing and that there are other elements that are out there. That is true. But there are also elements that are supported by scientific evidence that is equally strong as DNA. And the comments, the issues that he raises with respect to non-DNA evidence don't challenge the DNA evidence. The DNA evidence can show, because it's dated, it can show the time. There's other evidence that helps define that, but we do know the time. There are a lot of things. We do know that she was intoxicated, and heavily so. We understand that there are a lot of elements out there, but those things are still solid and are still there, and the other evidence does not change that. So I think what the state really feels is that there is room in the ex post facto analysis to allow for a case of this sort. I recognize it's a difficult sell in a lot of respects, but the fundamentals that come down through this, and it's a quote, I believe it came from Beazle versus Ohio, that I'm going to read to you that I think really kind of sums it up. And that is, and essentially, the statute of limitations doesn't change the fundamental aspects of this case. It doesn't change the details. And the quote is, "The punishment, which it renders possible by forbidding the defense of lapse of time, is exactly what the law provided when the fact transpired. No bending of language, no supplying of implied meanings, can in natural reason work out the contrary conclusion. The running of the old statute had taken from the court the right to proceed against the offender, leaving the violated without its former remedy. But it had not obliterated the fact that the law forbade the act when it was done, or removed from the doer's mind his original consciousness of guilt." That is still there, and that is still there with respect to the case that we have today. And so I suggest to your honors that perhaps there is room for change, that there is room for a case like this, and maybe it's not the right case, but I think that there is time to think about that the underlying statutes and the underlying purposes are changed by some of the evidence that we now have available today that do not change what was in place at the time that the act was committed. And that's what truly the ex post facto law is trying to do, is to prevent you from making changes to that. And with that, I submit and thank you, Your Honor, for your consideration and your time.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel. This is an important